but I waved them back down. "So what's your stake this time?" I asked. "Something I should be worried about?" She lifted up a bottle of red eye, still not turning to look at me. "Every time I lose a hand, the bottle gets passed. I've only had to pass it twice," she sighed dramatically. "Colonel Bodine really should be more careful about locking his liquor cabinet." Her head tilted as if she was weighing a thought. Or maybe it was locked. I took the bottle from her and set it in the middle of the table, then shoved the pile she'd accumulated into the middle as well. "Gentlemen, enjoy your game." "It's been a pleasure," she said to her new comrades, and put her hand out for me to escort her. Neither of us said a word until we were outside. I turned to face her, rested my hands on her waist, and then gently kissed her. "It's not like you to give in so easily." "They were nice young men, but lousy players. It was only something to pass the time."
"And taking Colonel Bodine's red eye was a challenge?"
"It was a more genteel stake than the one I offered last time. I was only thinking of you."
"Well, thank you for that, I think.
What spawned this diversion?"
She eyed me with frustration.
"It seemed everywhere I went today I needed King Jackson's permission to pass. First, the merchant wagons outside, then trying to access the outpost wall, and finally Tavish all but threw me out of the surgeon's bungalow."
"What were you doing in there?"
My tone came out sharper than I meant it to, and she stepped free from the circle of my hands. "What difference does it make?"
"We need to talk."
Her expression sobered. "About what?"
"In my tent."
Chapter 27.
He nearly dragged me across the courtyard, and my thoughts tumbled, trying to figure out what had disturbed him so. Colonel Bodine's red eye? Playing an innocent game of cards? Or had something happened in his meetings today? As soon as we were in his tent, he spun. Every muscle in his face was tight with restraint. A vein twitched at his temple. "What is it, Rafe? Are you all right?" He walked over to a bedside table and poured a goblet of water, swilling it back in one swallow. He offered me none. He looked at the goblet in his hand, and I feared it might shatter in his grip. He set it down carefully on the table as if it held poison. "It's probably not important," he said. I huffed a disbelieving breath. "It clearly is. Just say it." He turned to face me fully. There was a mountain of challenge in his stance, and I felt my shoulders bracing. "Did you kiss him?" he asked. I knew he could only mean Caden. "You saw me kiss him when you were alone together in the Camlanto." "Once." "You told me nothing happened." "Nothing did," I answered slowly, wondering what had brought this all on. "It was a kiss, Rafe. That was all."
"Did he force himself on you?"
"No, he did not."
"Was it part of your escape strategy?"
"No." His jaw rippled with tension.
"Did you enjoy it?"
I prickled at his insinuating tone. He had no right to interrogate me as if I had committed a crime. "Yes, I did enjoy it. Do you want to hear every last detail?" "I was scared, Rafe. I was alone. I was tired. And I thought you were a farmer I'd never see again. You had moved on without me. I was desperate for something to hold on to, but I learned that Caden wasn't that something. It was one kiss in a lonely moment, and you can turn it into anything sordid that you like, but I won't apologize for it." "He said he slept beside you every night." "On bedrolls! I also slept by Grizz, Eben, and the whole smelly lot. And let's not forget the snakes and vermin. Unfortunately, there were no private rooms available at the lovely inns on our holiday route." He paced the floor, shaking his head, his hands still drawn into fists.
I knew when he said it he was taunting me, but then when Tavish told me he saw him holding your hand...
I hurt my hand, Rafe. Caden was pulling out slivers. That is all. I made every effort to cool my own rising temper. I knew Rafe was under tremendous strain, and it appeared Caden had taken advantage of that. I pulled on his arm so he had to face me.
You have to make your peace with Caden, and he with you. You are not on opposite sides anymore. Do you understand?
He looked at me, the line of his jaw still tight with anger, but he reached out and lifted my hands. He examined the one that was scratched and red.
I'm sorry, he whispered.
He pulled my hand to his lips, kissing a knuckle and lingering there, his breath warming my skin.
Please forgive me.
I withdrew my hand. Wait here, I said, and headed for the tent door before he could argue. I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
To the privy. I kept my rage in check until I was outside the tent. There was far more that still needed to be settled. There wasn't a lot of arguing this time when I told the guards to move aside. They must have seen something in my expression. Maybe everyone did. Grizz and Jeb lifted their heads from pillows, but Caden, Oren, and Tavish all rose as I walked in. I stopped in front of Caden, my hands shaking with fury. His eyes narrowed. He knew exactly why I was there.
Don't you ever undermine me again, or dare to insinuate things that aren't true.
He asked. I only told him the truth.
I can't help how he twisted it in his own mind.
You mean how you laid it out for him to twist?
I thought we both agreed to be honest. You kissed me. Or maybe you're leading him along, too. My hand shot out, slamming across his face. He grabbed my arm and yanked me close. Wake up, Leah! Can't you see what's going on here?
In almost the same movement, the hot slice of metal filled the air, and both Tavish's and Oren's swords were at Caden's heart.
"Unhand the princess," Tavish growled. "Now."
Caden slowly released his grip, and Oren pushed him back several steps with the tip of his sword, but Caden's eyes never left mine. I heard more footsteps. Rafe was walking toward us.
"There's someone else who needs to be honest besides you and me," Caden said. "I thought you were in on the story from the beginning, but then I realized you didn't get it."
"Get what?"
"The excuse he conjured so quickly. The port and the few hills. Why do you think the Komazar bought it? You really think the marriage was only about an alliance? Dalbrecht doesn't give a horse's ass about the Morghese army. They mock you." The port was all they ever wanted, and the esteemed first daughter of the House of Morrigan was going to be their leverage.
I had no air. I couldn't force words to my tongue. Instead, a blur whirled in my head.
There's a port we want in Morrigan and a few miles of hills. The rest is yours.
The prince has grand dreams. Is it worth it to have any other kind?
I never thought it was right.
Do you think the prince knew?
He knew. I turned and looked at Rafe. Another secret? His lips were half parted, and he looked like he'd been punched in the gut. Or had been caught. The anger burning at my temples drained away. My stomach floated loosely in my chest. Rafe reached out for me.
Leah, let me explain. That's not how...
I stepped back, avoiding his reach, and turned to look at everyone else. Tavish and Oren shifted uncomfortably but met my stare. Jeb looked away. Their expressions confirmed I was a pawn in a game that was so old it was practically a joke. The floor seemed to bob. I tried to find footing in this truth that rolled through the room like an unwelcome tide. I hugged my arms to my waist, every limb suddenly feeling awkward and out of place. I skimmed their gazes, felt the shake of my head in a distant, detached way. How very disappointing it must have been for Dalbrech to learn I was a branded criminal in Morrigan. Being worthless to my own kingdom made me a worthless game piece to yours as well. My apologies. The wobble in my voice only added to my humiliation. It seemed I was a grave disappointment to every kingdom on the continent. Caden looked at me, his expression morose, as if he knew he'd gone too far. When I turned to leave, Rafe tried to stop me, but I jerked free, shaking my head, unable to speak, my throat swollen with shame as I ran out the door. I rushed across the courtyard, the ground a sickening blur beneath me. He knew. I had been so worried about the sham my parents were perpetrating, when all along it had mattered not one whit to Dalbrech if I had the gift at all. My worth to them lay elsewhere. Leverage. The word cut deeply. I'd heard it so many times, the cabinet uttering it with a smug smile in regard to one lesser kingdom or another, one county lord or another, all the ways they used tactical pressure to get something, couching it in a word that appeared so diplomatic and practical, but was laced with force and threat.
"It is the way these things are done," my father had said, trying to explain it. "A little pressure, and they pay attention."
"Leah," I felt a tug at my elbow and whirled, yanking it loose. I didn't give Rafe a chance to say more. "How dare you!" I screamed. My anger returned full force. His shoulders squared. "If you'd let me, how dare you lay guilt on me for one stupid kiss when all along you had this sham of epic proportions on your conscience? It wasn't. You and your conniving kingdom turned my entire life upside down over a port. A port! You aren't getting the... Oh, believe me, I get it. I get everything now. I... Stop cutting me off!" he yelled. The steel of his eyes sparked with warning. "The least you can do is give me a chance to speak. We're going to talk." We sat on the outpost wall. He had led me there, maybe wanting a place where no one would hear us, maybe trying to make amends, knowing I had been turned away from there earlier. He had dismissed the guards in our section of the wall, saying we would keep watch. They had raised their eyebrows. The king keeping watch. But it was as natural for Rafe as his arm was on my shoulder now. Our legs dangled over the wall's edge. How far we had come. Now he joined me on precarious ledges. He hadn't denied it, or tried to justify it, but he had promised the alliance wasn't only about the port, and by the time he was done speaking, I believed him. It was about a lot of things, not the least of which was foolish pride and the need to reclaim a part of their history and what had once belonged to the exiled prince. But there was a practical side to their motivations as well. Dalbrech, too, had heard the reports of the growing Venden population, and they'd had more incidents with barbarian patrols. Maintaining the Dalbrech army was the largest expense of the treasury. Of all the kingdoms, Morrigan had the next largest army. It was true that Dalbrech viewed their forces as superior to Morrigan's, but they also knew they could use resources elsewhere if they didn't have to maintain such a large military. An alliance could mean cutting back on their western outposts, and the profits from a deep-water port on the western coast would help finance the rest. After I was within their borders, they would press for the return of the port, claiming it as a dowry. Press. Another innocuous word, like leverage. I didn't even want to unravel all its nuances. So, after they secured a political alliance, they set their sights on more, and I'd be the winning game piece clutched in their palms. He stared out at the darkening horizon.
"I wouldn't have let it happen, Leah."
"You're a king now, Rafe," I said, and jumped down from our perch onto the walk. Will you devise new ways to get it? He followed after me and pressed his palms against the watchtower wall, pinning me between his arms. A scowl darkened his eyes. It doesn't matter who or what I am or what the cabinet wants. You are what matters to me, Leah. If you don't know that already, I'll find 100 more ways to show you. I love you more than a port, more than an alliance, more than my own life. Your interests are my interests. Are we going to let the conspiracies and schemes of kingdoms come between us? His dark lashes cut a shadow under his eyes. His gaze searched mine, and then the turmoil receded and was replaced with something else, a need that had gone too long unquenched. It matched my own, and I felt its heat spreading low in my gut. It was only Wraith and me. Kingdoms disappeared. Duties disappeared. Only the two of us and everything we had ever been to each other, and everything I still wanted us to be. No kingdom will come between us, I whispered. Ever. Our lips drew closer, and I leaned into him, wanting every part of him to be part of me, too. Our mouths meeting, his embrace gentle, and then passionate, wanting more. His lips traced a line down my neck and then nudged my dress from my shoulder. My breaths shuddered and my hands slipped beneath his vest, my fingertips burning as they slid over the muscles of his stomach. We're supposed to be keeping watch, I said breathlessly. He quickly signaled a sentry below to resume his patrol of the wall and turned his attention back to me. Let's go to my tent, he whispered between kisses. I swallowed, trying to form a coherent answer. You aren't worried about your reputation? I'm more worried about my sanity. No one will see us. Do you have anything with you here? I didn't want to end up in Pauline's predicament. Yes. His tent was only steps away, but still almost as far as a lifetime when I knew how quickly the fates could turn on a moment and rip it away. We're here now, Wraith, and the watchtower is warm. Who needs a tent? The world vanished. We closed the door, pulled the shutter tight, lit a candle, threw a woolen blanket to the floor. My fingers trembled and he kissed them, concern filling his eyes. We don't have to. I'm only afraid this isn't real, that it's only another one of my dreams that I'll wake from. This is our dream, Leah. Together. No one can wake us. We lay on the blanket, and his face hovered over mine. My prince. My farmer. The blue of his eyes as deep as a midnight ocean, and I was lost in them, floating, weightless. His lips slowly skimmed my skin, exploring, tender, setting every inch of me on fire, the room and time disappearing. And then his eyes were looking into mine again, and his hand slipped behind me, lifting me closer to him, the yearning of weeks and months burning, and the fears that we'd never be together, dissolving. The vows we made to each other, the trust written on our souls, all of it swept past me as he brought his mouth back to mine. Our hands knotted, and the rhythm of his breaths surrounded me. Every kiss, every touch, was a promise that we both knew. I was his, and he was mine. And no conspiracy or scheme of kingdoms had a fraction of the power that surged between us.
Chapter 28.
We hurried up the steps of the veranda, neither of us feeling guilty about being late for dinner, but we were both caught by surprise when we saw Caden and Grizz among the guests. Captain Haig took particular delight in whispering, "As per your orders," as I passed him. The timing for listening to me couldn't have been worse, and he knew it. Rafe's hand tensed in mine when he saw them. Making peace with Caden was still a long way off for him. As uneasy as everyone at the table was with their presence, I knew none were as uncomfortable as Caden and Grizz. To Caden's credit, he avoided saying anything that might be construed as combative. He seemed contrite, even, which I hoped was a sign he regretted his method of delivering honesty. The unsaid and the innuendo had tarnished his truth. I supposed we all needed practice at it. Truth was a harder skill to master than swinging a sword. Even Jeb had come to dinner, refusing to be confined to bed any longer. I could only imagine the pain he'd had to endure to wriggle his arm and shoulder into the freshly pressed shirt, but he wore it with style and pride. Crevasse linen, no doubt. Banter turned to the upcoming party plans, and spirits grew lighter. Our dinner mates seemed to grow more at ease with Grizz's and Caden's presence, though even their smallest gestures were still monitored. Rafe made it through the evening with considerable restraint, though several times during dinner his hand strayed to my knee beneath the table. I think he enjoyed watching me stumble over my words. I returned the distraction when he was deep in conversation with Captain Azia. After having to begin the same sentence 3 times, he reached under the table and squeezed my hand to stop me from drawing lazy circles on his thigh. Captain Azia blushed as if he knew the game we played. The next day was crowded with more duty for Rafe. I saw the weight of it in his eyes. He'd had to muster incredible self-control back at the sanctum, keeping up a charade day after day by playing a conniving emissary, and now he had been thrust into another new role, one that came with enormous expectation. I was walking past his tent when I heard strained voices within. Rafe and Sven were arguing. I stooped near the curtained door to relace my boot and listen. A message had arrived saying the rotation of troops would be delayed a few days, but it also brought news of a growing rift between the Assembly and the Cabinet. "That's it," Rafe had yelled. "We're going back now, escort or no escort." Sven stood his ground. "Don't be a damned fool. The message Bodine sent has arrived at the palace by now. It will announce you're alive and well and on your way, but you can't discount the fact that enemies will also know you're on your way. It's too big a risk. A large escort is prudent. Knowing you're alive is enough to calm the Assembly until we get there." Rafe's reaction to Cabinet squabbles seemed excessive, and I wondered if I had missed something, or maybe the news had simply added to his impatience. Rafe wasn't the only one growing impatient. With each passing day, I was more certain I needed to leave. The pull grew stronger, and I had restless dreams. In them I heard pieces of the Song of Venda, a jumbled melody punctuated by my own breathless running, though in the dreams my feet refused to move, as if they had grown into the ground beneath me. And then came the low rumble of something approaching. I felt its hot breath on my back, something hungry and determined, the refrain sounding over and over, "For when the dragon strikes, it is without mercy." I would startle awake, trying to catch my breath, my back stinging with the memory of sharp claws slicing into me, and then I would hear the Komazar's words as clearly as if he stood beside me. "If any royals survive our conquest, it will give me great pleasure to lock them up on this side of hell." After a particularly restless night, I went into Rafe's tent the next morning while he was still dressing. He was in the middle of shaving. I didn't bother with greetings. "Rafe, we have to talk about my going to Morrigan to warn them." He studied me in the reflection of his mirror and dipped his lathered razor in the basin to rinse it. "Leah, we've already talked about this. The Komazar is gravely injured or dead, and the Sanctum is in chaos with more dead.
You saw how the council was, like a pack of hungry dogs. They're tearing each other apart right now. He took another swipe at his neck. And none of those left have the ability to lead any kind of army anyway.
For now, we hope. But I can't take a chance on guesses. I need to go back and—
Leah, the bridge is destroyed. They can't even get across.
Bridges can be fixed.
He dropped the razor in the basin and turned to look at me. What about the bounty on your head? You can't just waltz back into Morrigan. We'll send word, I promise.
Word? To whom, Wraith? There are traitors in the cabinet conspiring with the Komazar, and I don't know how many. I wouldn't know who to trust, and the Chancellor intercepts—
He wiped his face with a towel. Leah, I can't go back to Morrigan right now. You know that. You've seen the turmoil my own kingdom is in. I have to settle things there first. We have time to figure this out.
He didn't get what I was trying to say. I knew he couldn't go to Morrigan with me, but I saw the look in his eyes. He wanted me to trust him. Time felt like precious sips of water slipping through my fingers. His gaze was unwavering, bright and sure. I nodded. I'd give it a few more days, out of necessity, if nothing else. The physician had said Grizz couldn't ride a horse or wield a weapon yet. The long neglect of his wound made it slow to heal, but the healthy flesh was beginning to knit together, if he was careful and didn't tear it loose again. Wraith buckled on his scabbard and gave me a quick kiss before he left. The officers were riding out to observe training exercises. He seemed relieved to be doing something within the realm of his expertise, being a soldier, instead of arguing with Sven or Bodine about court matters. I stood in the doorway of his tent watching him walk away, wishing it was simply a matter of sending word to Morrigan, but I knew a messenger from Dalbrek probably wouldn't even make it past the border alive. The next morning, Vila, Adeline, and Madame Rathbone brought more dresses to my tent, trying to find something for me to wear for the party the next evening. After much fussing, they settled on a deep blue velvet dress, Dalbrech blue, with a silver sash.
"We'll put together the other accessories," Vila said. "Unless you'd prefer to?"
I left it to them to figure out, as Vila suggested. I liked a beautiful gown as well as anyone, but it was probably obvious to all of them that I didn't fuss over the particulars of fashion.
"Do you mind if I ask?" Adeline blushed.
"Never mind," she said, shaking away her question.
"Please," I said, "speak freely."
"It seems that you and King Jackson have genuine feelings for each other, and it just made me wonder..."
"Why did you run from the wedding?"
Vila finished for her.
"They claim it was a deliberate snub planned by Morrigan all along," Adeline added.
I refrained from rolling my eyes.
"That is just bruised ego speaking," I answered, "and a court full of men who couldn't believe a girl could derail all their plans. The Morrigan's cabinet was just as angry as Dalbrech's. My departure wasn't nearly as dramatic as a conspiracy. I simply left of my own accord because I was afraid."
Adeline twisted the silver sash in her hand.
"Afraid of the prince?"
"No," I sighed.
"The prince was probably the least of it. I was afraid of the unknown. I was afraid of the sham and the gift I thought I lacked. I was afraid of all the lost choices I would never be able to make, and that for the rest of my life someone would always be telling me what to do or say or think, even when I had better ideas of my own. I was afraid of never being anything but what suited others and being pushed and prodded until I fit the mold they shoved me into and I forgot who I was and what I wanted. And, maybe most of all, I was afraid I would never be loved beyond what a piece of paper had ordered. That's enough fear to make any girl jump on a horse and ride away, princess or not, don't you think?"
They stared at me, and I saw the understanding in their eyes. Madame Rathbone nodded.
"Enough and then some."
I walked,
trying to ignore the rattle of the belts and weapons of the guard escort trailing behind me. They reverberated like an entire marching army in the midst of the peaceful marketplace of wagons. But the king's orders were to be followed to the letter, 6 guards and not one less. I stopped to check on Dihara first, then went in search of Natia. Like Dihara, Natia had been orphaned when she was a baby. Her parents' wagon had lost a wheel and tumbled down a mountainside. By some miracle, Natia had been spared, and together the tribe had raised her. Dihara, Rina, they had all been her mothers. I found her down at the river's edge, alone, staring at the calm, rippling waters, supervising a bevy of fishing lines thrown into the water. The guards hung back, and I sat down beside her, but her focus on the river remained constant, as if it flowed with dreams and memories. "They told me you were here," she said, still staring straight ahead. "Thanks to you," I answered. With a single finger, I gently turned her chin so she had to look at me. Her large brown eyes glistened. I frightened a man twice my size with that little knife. He had hurt a small child, and I threatened to cut off his nose. You took a stand, Natia. It helped me to take one, too. She looked back at the river. My stand didn't go well. Neither did mine. That will never stop me from taking them. Once we fear to take a stand, tyranny will have won. Then why do I feel that we've lost everything? I pulled in a slow, shaky breath, feeling the price she had paid. There are more battles to be fought, Natia. This isn't the end. Tears trickled down her cheeks. It is for Dihara. A sickening twinge wrenched my chest. This was Natia's reality, and mine. Were any losses worth the gains? I struggled with the same doubts I saw in her eyes. Dihara had sent me here to speak to her, but really, what did I have to offer? I was still trying to find my own way. Once, when I was feeling despair over bad fortune, Dihara told me we're all part of a greater story, one that transcends even our own tears. You're part of that greater story now too, Natia. You listened to the truth speaking within you. It may not seem like it right now, but you're stronger today than you were yesterday. Tomorrow, you'll be even stronger. She turned to look at me, the same defiance in her face as the day I'd left her in the vagabond camp. I want to go with you, she said. My stomach gripped. I wasn't prepared for this. I saw the hunger in her eyes, but I also saw Aster. It filled me with fear and renewed grief. I wouldn't let this part of the story be hers. Not yet, Natia. You're too young. I'm 13 now, and a woman, the same as you. My blood rushed and my thoughts tumbled like 1,000 tiny stones in a swollen river. Chaliev Onbari, I said. Your time will come, I promise. For now, your family still needs you. Be strong for them. She stared at me and finally nodded, but I was certain she remained unconvinced, and my own shortcomings seemed evident again. A fishing line tugged, and she jumped up, giving it a sharp jerk to snag the hook deep in the fish's mouth. I sat on the watchtower wall looking out at the rolling plain. An orange ball of fire settled into the earth, the rippling line of the horizon slowly swallowing it up as if it were nothing, as if all the sun's timeless power were merely warm, frosted confection, gone in a single bite. All that was left in its wake was an orange glow that lit the edges of spiked ruins in the distance. Rafe said legend claimed the ruins were what remained of a great stronghold that once held all the wealth of the ancients, Now the works of the demigods were little more than scars on a landscape, reminders that even the great, with all their wealth and knowledge, can fall. Somewhere beyond all that, on an unseeable horizon, was Morrigan and all the people who lived there, going about their lives, unaware. My brothers, Pauline, Birdie, Gwyneth, and more patrols like Walther's who would meet their deaths, as unaware as I had once been.
I want to go with you.
Where I was going was no place for Natia. It was hardly a place for me.
Chapter 29. Rafe.
May I have a turn? I wiped the sweat dripping from my face with my sleeve. I knew a crowd was watching my sparring exercises with other soldiers, but I hadn't known Leah was among them. I turned, following the sound of her voice. She hopped down from the paddock rail and walked toward me. I waved off the soldier who was poised to spar with me next. I had seen her use a sword in our escape from the sanctum, but that was in surprise attacks, and I didn't know how well she really knew how to spar. It wouldn't hurt for her to expand her skills. "All right," I answered. "I could use the practice," she said as she approached. "I had training with my brothers, but they emphasized dirty fighting." "There's no other kind when you're fighting for your life. First thing, let's find a sword that's suited for you." I walked over to the rack of practice swords, testing their weights. "Try this one." It was a lighter sword that wouldn't fatigue her arm as quickly, but still had a decent reach. I selected a shield for her, too. Sven stepped forward. "Your Majesty, is this wise?" Leah leveled a death stare at him. I knew she was already weary of every decision being deferred to me. "We'll be fine, Colonel." "Astute move, Your Majesty," Leah said under her breath, "or I might have had to take your steward down." We went through a few slow thrusts and parries so she could get the feel of her weapon, and then I applied more pressure. "Don't use your sword to block or defend unless you have to," I said, as our blows reverberated through the yard. "Advance! The sword is a killing weapon, not a defensive one. If you're using it to defend, you're missing a chance to kill." I showed her how to use her shield to deflect and unbalance her opponent to her best advantage, while at the same time using her sword to thrust and cut. "Attack!" I yelled, baiting her just as I did the other soldiers. "Attack! Don't wait for me to wear you down. Keep me on the move. Let surprise be your ally." She did. In earnest. The dust kicked up around us. The soldiers hooted. I had no doubt it was the first time they'd ever seen a woman sparring in the workyard, with their king, no less. Her reflexes were fast, and her concentration dogged. Excellent qualities for a swordsman. But I had the advantage of height, weight, and strength, as most opponents she might face would. To her advantage, she seemed to naturally understand the concept of movement and timing. Some soldiers planted their feet like trees, as if their sheer size would keep them upright. I had seen many of them felled by soldiers not much bigger than Leah. Her face glistened with sweat, and I was caught by a surge of pride. "Watch your shins," someone called out. I glanced toward the crowd. Caden. Our audience had grown. Her sword skimmed my ribs and cheers erupted. Like a wolf tasting blood, her thrusts became ravenous, her movement a graceful chaos that kept me increasingly alert. I advanced, pressing harder, and her strike slowed against the pressure. I knew every sinew in her shoulder had to be burning with fire. "Go for the kill," I yelled, "before the choice is taken from you." She was a fast learner, using her shield well, deflecting my blows expertly. But then a piercing horn sounded, dividing her attention. I pulled back on my swing, but not before the flat of the sword caught her in the jaw, and she went flying backward to the ground. The shocked groan of the crowd ricocheted through the yard, and I rushed to her side, falling to the ground. I gathered her into my arms. "Leah, my gods, are you all right?" Soldiers closed in around us, and I yelled for someone to get the physician. She grimaced, reaching up to hold her jaw where the redness was already turning blue. "Stupid," she hissed. "I'm sorry, I didn't. Not you, me. Walther told me 100 times I couldn't let in distractions." She pushed my hand away and opened her mouth, testing to see that her jaw was in working order. "I still have all my teeth. Stop fussing." The horn sounded again. "What is it?" she asked. I wasn't sure. A warning or a welcome? I looked up at the watchtower, and a soldier waved the Dalbrick banner. "Our soldiers!" he yelled. The rotation of troops had arrived. I'd be able to leave for Dalbrick with Leah at last.
Chapter 30.
That evening, no one mentioned my tumble. Whether to spare me or their king, I wasn't sure. But if Sven said anything, I was prepared to point out that 2 of Rafe's sparring partners had fared worse, one a knot on the head, and the other a cracked knuckle. I hadn't sparred with Rafe to prove a point the way I had with Caden. I knew a time might come when I would need greater sword skills, and I wanted to learn from the best. With the arrival of the troops, everyone lingered over dinner, then dessert, eagerly eating up news of home from the newly arrived officers Taggart and Durante. While both officers were relieved to learn that Prince Jackson had been found alive, I noticed Rafe grew quieter as the evening progressed and news was shared. Some of the reports were lackluster: betrothals, harvests, promotions in the ranks. But when it turned to the squabbles among the assembly and cabinet, and the rumblings of generals, Rafe's eyes narrowed and his fingers curled around the arm of his chair. "We leave in 2 days. It will all be addressed soon enough," he said. His tense composure didn't escape the officers, and further news of grumbling generals stalled on their lips. Colonel Bodine turned the conversation back to a lighter topic, the party that was planned for the next evening, and he noted the good timing of the troops' arrival. Apparently, Officers Taggart and Durante were well-versed in Bodine's celebrations.
"Be prepared, ladies," Taggart said. "There aren't enough of you to go around. You'll be dancing all night."
"That's fine by me," Viola said.
The other women chimed in with agreement.
"You too, Your Highness,"
Captain Haig said, lifting his glass to me. This prompted another round of toasting, this time to dancing. Soon the conversation turned elsewhere, and I became lost in my own thoughts, as detached from the party plans as Rafe seemed to be. I fingered the bone in my pocket, feeling a strange emptiness that a party wasn't able to fill. I had accumulated a small pile of bones back in my tent. It was a habit I couldn't let go of, the jingling tokens of remembrance and worry for those I had left behind. I feared the cruelties they would suffer at the hands of the Komazar, and worried for the greater needs that still lay ahead. Morrigan could be extinguished, snuffed from memory with only a few broken memorials to prove we were ever there. Shouts jostled me from my thoughts. Everyone startled, looking toward the door. An angry scuffle was going on outside on the veranda. The door slivered open, and a soldier entered, apologizing profusely for the interruption.
"We found one, Your Majesty, just like you said. Caught him lurking around the back wall. He's a small one, but wild. He slashed one of our guards on the arm before we could tackle him. He's demanding to see,
He looked down briefly as if embarrassed.
"He wants to see the princess. He says he knows her."
Rafe, Caden, Grizz, and I were all on our feet.
"Bring him in," Rafe said.
We heard more yelling, then 2 guards stumbled in trying to control their prisoner.
"Hold your place before I knock your head into the next world," one guard growled.
The prisoner locked eyes with me, and my heart stopped. It was Eben. Though I knew better than to fawn over him, I couldn't stop myself and ran, pulling him from the guard's grip. Caden and Grizz were right behind me. "Eben!" I drew him into my arms. "Thank the gods you're alive!" His arms circled around me, unashamed, and I felt all the ribs and angles of his thin body. I pushed back an arm's length to look at him. His cheekbones were sharp, and his eyes hollow and circled with shadows. He was half-starved and looked more like a wild animal than a boy. Dried, spattered blood covered his clothing. I saw emotion well in Grizz's and Caden's faces. Caden stepped forward, grabbed fistfuls of Eben's shirt, and pulled him roughly into his arms.
Drajon.
Brother. Eben was their comrade, a rattan in training. Grizz did the same, then checked a scrape on Eben's cheek. When I turned from our tight-knit circle, I saw Rafe watching us, not with curiosity like everyone else, but with dark scrutiny. Caden's shoulder brushed up against mine, and I stepped away, creating some distance between us. Eben's attention shot to Rafe, and he eyed him suspiciously. He had only known Rafe as Dalbrek's emissary, and I realized he probably still didn't know Rafe's true position here. His gaze shifted to Jeb, once a filthy Venden patty-clapper, hardly recognizable now with his neatly combed hair and pristine clothing. Next he looked at Sven, the one-time governor of Arlston, who now wore a high-ranking officer's uniform, and then Orin, the governor's mute guard, also in Dalbrek uniform, drinking from a crystal goblet. Orin grinned.
"Surprise," he said, lifting his glass toward Eben.
I made introductions.
"Ficatan de Shimentras,"
Eben said under his breath. I looked at Rafe, wondering just how many of the choice Venden words he knew.
"Yes, we're liars," Rafe said, answering my question. He leaned forward, aiming a frigid stare at Eben. "We lied to save the princess's life. Do you object to that?"
Eben's chin lifted, defiant, but then he shook his head. Rafe sat back in his chair.
"Good. Now someone bring the boy some food. We have talking to do."
Colonel Bodine suggested it was a good time for the officers and their wives to retire for the evening. They all left except for Captain Haig. It was more like an interrogation than talking. Rafe, Caden, Grizz, Tavish, Sven, and I all took turns asking questions as Eben wolfed down food. He had barely escaped with his life. He had been in the far eastern paddock with Spirit when they came for him. His voice wobbled when he mentioned the name of the young foal that he had to leave behind. He was oblivious to what had happened back on the Sanctum Terrace, but he saw Traherne, Ivor, and Cyrus, one of the tower guards, kill a paddy-clapper without a word. He knew something was wrong, and when they caught sight of him, he knew he was next. He ran, hiding in stalls, barns, between stacks of hay, wherever he could as they chased him down. Finally, Cyrus cornered him in a loft. Eben killed him with a pitchfork in his chest. He spent the rest of the day moving from one hiding place to the next, finally ending up in an abandoned room in the South Tower, where he was trapped for 2 days. That was where he pieced together what had happened. Because of his close association with Grizz, he had been targeted. Anyone who was known to have been intimately speaking with the princess, Grizz, Caden, or Fywell was suspected as a traitor and systematically hunted down. He heard the screams of the slaughtered. He closed his eyes, and I thought he might not open them again. When he did, his lids were heavy and his eyes swam in his head. It wasn't terror, but exhaustion undoing him. His head lolled briefly to the side. With a full stomach, he was barely able to stay conscious.
"Where did you stay in the South Tower?" Caden asked.
"Right below the Commissar's room. I could hear almost everything through the flue."
"Do you know who he sent to hunt us down?" I asked. Eben rattled off the names of everyone sent after us. He saw them leave from his hiding place. We had killed everyone he mentioned back in the Valley of the Giants, except for one who hadn't been among our attackers. Malik. Which meant he was still out there somewhere. Eben, I asked, before I lost him completely. Is the Komazar ruling now? Eben looked at me, fear briefly pushing aside the stupor in his eyes. He nodded as if too afraid to speak the Komazar's name. The ghouls down in the caverns took care of him with their own potions. He's different now. He wants us all dead, and I'm the only one who didn't do anything.
Except slash one of my men, Rafe said. What am I going to do about that?
It was only a scratch on his arm, Eben chided. Probably won't even need a stitch. He shouldn't have gotten in my way.
Rafe looked across the room at the guard who had brought in Eben. The guard nodded confirmation, and Rafe turned back to Eben, this time with a sterner gaze.
And where do your loyalties lie now, Eben? He asked. Not with your kind, he answered, a snarl lifting his lip. But then his head bowed, and he whispered, with all the misery and confusion the world could hold. But not with the Komazar, either. He'd been cut loose from the only life he knew, for a second time.
His focus shifted to the far wall, and then his head fell back against his chair, his eyes closed and his mouth open, finally succumbing to his exhaustion. He started to fall to the side, but Rafe grabbed him, scooping his limp body into his arms.
"I'll be right back," he said, saying he was taking him to the physician's barracks to bunk, and to check on the soldier Eben had slashed.
"Be sure to post a guard on the urchin," Sven reminded him as he walked out.
Rafe's footsteps faded, and the room was heavy with silence. Then a few mumbled words erupted among the officers. Unimportant words. Nothing like the ones that pounded in my head. The Komazar rules Venda. It was the truth I had known all along. The truth Rafe had tried to deny. The truth even the Komazar knew as he lay bleeding. It's not over. Even Dihara whispered to me, "Jezinter, be brave." She knew it was only beginning. He wants us all dead. The vision I'd had of Sivika when I was back in the sanctum seeped into the air before me again, like fingers of curling smoke that had been waiting just outside my field of vision. The citadel was destroyed, the ruins only broken fangs on the horizon, and piles upon piles of bodies lined the roads like stacked stones in a wall. The cries of a shackled few, to be taken back to Venda as prisoners, hung in the smoky air. Their moans wove through other voices, Rafe's, the Komazar's, the priests, Venda's, and Dihara's, too.
"We'll send word, I promise. It's my turn now to sit on a golden throne in Morrigan. The bridge is destroyed. They can't even get across. The dragon knows only hunger. Trust your gifts, Arabella, whatever they might be. We call them our death steeds. Sometimes a gift requires great sacrifice. You'll know what you need to do. Don't tarry, Miz. Or they will all die. This last unknowing within me as certain as a sunrise. They will die." The smoky haze before my eyes vanished, and I met the stares of everyone seated around the table.
"Your Highness?" Jeb asked cautiously, his pupils pinpoints. Everyone else's gaze looked much the same. What had they seen in my face?
I stood. "Colonel Bodine, I'll be leaving first thing in the morning, along with Caden." I turned to Grizz.
Once you're completely healed, you and Eben can catch up with us somewhere in Morrigan, but you can't ride yet. I need you fit and healthy, not as an added worry. I spoke quickly and firmly, not giving Grizz or anyone else a chance to protest. Colonel, we'll need our horses readied and additional supplies, including weapons if you can spare them. I promise that I'll repay. What are you talking about? Everyone's attention turned toward the doorway of the dining room. Rafe stood there, tall and formidable, his eyes blazing. By his strained tone, it was obvious he had heard me, but I said it again anyway. I was just telling Colonel Bodine that I'm returning to Morrigan in the morning. Any doubt about the Komazar and his intentions are gone now, and I...
Leah, you and I will discuss this later. For now...
No, I said. We've already talked, Rafe, and I can't put it off any longer. I'm leaving. He walked across the room and took hold of my elbow.
May I speak with you in private, please?
Talking is not going to change.
Excuse us, please, he said to everyone as he led me out of the dining room, his grip tight on my arm.
He shut the doors behind us and turned on the veranda to face me.
Just what do you think you were doing in there? You can't go around giving my officers orders behind my back.
I blinked, taken aback by his immediate anger. It was hardly behind your back, Rafe. You were only gone for a few minutes.
It doesn't matter how long I was gone. I return and you're shouting orders for horses?
I struggled to keep my voice even. I was not shouting, as you are now.
If I'm shouting, it's because we've gone over this already and you don't seem to be listening. I told you I need time.
And time is a luxury I don't have. I will remind you it is my kingdom they are descending upon, not yours. I have a duty to...
Now?
He said, throwing his hands in the air. Now you suddenly decide that duty matters? You didn't seem to give a devil's hell about duty when you left me at the altar. I stared at him, a hive of bees swarming in my chest, and I desperately tried to swallow my growing irritation. I'm regrouping and moving forward with new information, just as some fool told me to do. He walked across the wooden veranda and then back again, his boots punctuating his growing anger. He stopped in front of me.
I didn't run across a whole continent and risk good officers' lives just to let you traipse back to a kingdom where you'll be killed.
You're assuming the worst, I said between gritted teeth.
You're damn right I am. You think one little lesson in swordplay and you're ready to take on a kingdom of traitorous cutthroats?
Swordplay? I trembled with fury at his dismissal of my abilities. I will remind you, King Jackson, that all of your fingers are intact now, thanks to me. You think you'd be giving anyone sword lessons without them? I endured weeks of the Komazar pawing me, beating me, and sticking his tongue down my throat to save your miserable life. And I will also remind you I felled 4 men in our escape. You are not letting me go anywhere. Where I go and what I do is still my choice to make. He didn't back down, and his eyes became molten steel, burning me with their heat.
No.
I looked at him uncertainly. What do you mean, no?
You can't go.
An incredulous puff of air escaped from my lips. You can't stop me.
You think not?
He stepped closer, his chest as imposing as a wall. His eyes glowed like a beast's.
Have you forgotten? I am the king of Dalbrek, he growled. And I decide who comes and goes here.
You're a damn fool is what you are, and I'm leaving. He turned toward the end of the veranda.
Guards!
The sentries standing at the railing immediately stepped forward.
Escort Princess Arabella back to her quarters, he ordered, and post 4 guards to see that she stays put.
I stood there, stunned with disbelief, trying to find my voice. Are you saying I've gone from being the prisoner of one kingdom to being the prisoner of another?
You can twist it into whatever warped thing you choose, which I'm sure you will, but you're going to your tent and staying there until you come to your senses.
I looked back at the guards. They stared at me anxiously, not sure how to proceed until Rafe told them, If she doesn't follow willingly, you have my permission to drag her.
I glared at him and spun, stomping down the steps with the guards hot on my heels.
Chapter 31. Caden.
We heard every word. When the shouting began, Sven